kboo.org, and email me if you have any music, and we'll see if we can get you on the program. So keep the faith, and I leave you with this: forever loving Jesus.
Forever loving Jesus. I waited such a long time, I don't lost my way. I waited such a long time, I'd almost lost my way. If not for His love and mercy, I don't know.
Check out Ear to the Streets of Portland with hosts Sequoina
and Kayla
every first and third Thursday of the month starting at 7 o'clock p.m.
Listen in as we interview community organizers, speak on issues focused on Black Portland, and share community events happening in the area and elsewhere.
Listen on the radio at 90.7 FM, online at www.kbu.fm, or from your mobile phone at m.kbu.fm.
Follow KBU on Instagram at KBU Radio. Ear to the Streets.
New year, new KBU. Thank you to everyone who contributed and supported us during our KBU Fights Back end-of-year campaign. With help from our community, we exceeded our $75,000 goal and will be able to continue bringing you grassroots, independent community radio.
Hello and welcome to Pathways, where you are invited to join me for a visit with leaders in personal development and cultural evolution. This is your host, Paul O'Brien. Is it possible to transform outrage into activism? There's plenty to be outraged about, but that isn't necessarily the most productive approach. However, advice for people contemplating next steps for strengthening communities, overcoming divisiveness, and resisting complacency can be hard to come by. How can we band together for social change, cultivate the specific qualities that make our lives and our world better, and live more heroically and meaningfully? Our guest today is John Pavlovitz, author of the new book, Hope and Other Superpowers, a life-affirming, love-defending, butt-kicking, world-saving manifesto. John is a pastor and blogger from Wake Forest, North Carolina. In the past 2 years, his blog, Stuff That Needs to Be Said, has reached a diverse audience of millions of people throughout the world, with an average monthly readership of over 1 million people. His home church, the North Raleigh Community Church, is a growing non-traditional Christian community dedicated to radical hospitality, mutual respect, and diversity of doctrine. Hello, John, and welcome to the Pathways program.
Thank you so much, Paul. It's so good to be with you today.
Okay, let's start by asking, what is a non-traditional Christian community?
Well, our community is a group of people that sort of the church grew out of a group of Christians who many of them had been in a fundamentalist or fairly conservative upbringing and kind of drifted from that, but were still sort of processing that faith deconstruction and welcoming other traditions and learning from those traditions, but still being tied to that Christian tradition. And so that's how the church began, with a group of people who were Christian but who were really open to other faith experiences. And that's sort of what we've kept doing for the past couple of decades now.
Okay. And in my intro, I mentioned that your community is dedicated to diversity of doctrine. What does that mean? I mean, does that mean you're not required to believe an orthodox dogma?
Yeah, the diversity of doctrine is that we really don't have a doctrinal statement, so there aren't, you know, things that you have to ascribe to. There, you know, we are very fairly we hold those things loosely, and we really are a relational community, and so we don't require people to subscribe to one kind of doctrinal position.
Okay, but there must be some basic beliefs that are baked in, like
yeah, that's right. I mean, the sort of the doorway or the path that we've been walking because of most of our upbringing has been the Gospels, has been the teachings of Jesus. And so that sort of still there undergirding all that, you know, all that we do, all that we kind of do in the community, but it's really trying to remove some of the baggage of tradition and history and a lot of that restrictive stuff that's been placed upon those teachings.
Okay. So let's talk about your book, Hope and Other Superpowers. Why do you consider hope a superpower? And of all the superpowers, why is it the one that makes the cover of your book?
Yeah, well, I think hope is sort of aspirational. I think it's that thing that kind of propels us into days we wouldn't otherwise walk into. And there are a lot of things tied to that, a lot of daily practices that in the present that sort of bear fruit later. But I think hope is the kind of thing that keeps us moving towards something better, towards something deeper, and you know, deeper understanding of what it means to be human, better connections with other people. So hope is just that thing that kind of draws us.
Right. And you bring up in the book that there's this pervasive sense of hopelessness these days. And I suspect that that's one of the reasons that hope takes center stage in your list of superpowers.
Yeah, I mean, you look on your Twitter feed, or you watch the news, or you walk out into your community, or you listen in on conversations, and you can see that fatigue that's there. I think people are exhausted, and I think they're frustrated, and many of them are facing disconnections that they hadn't faced before relationally. And so I think that is something that, as I've traveled the country talking to people, that's just there. And no matter what your political affiliation or religious tradition, I think everyone kind of feels that tension.
And what do you think is the cause of that? Is it Donald Trump? Is it the divisiveness that he's brought to the social spectrum?
Yeah, I certainly don't believe it's him. I think he's just been been an uncovering. I think he's revealed a lot that was there beneath the surface, and so I think we're having to address it, and we're seeing it more than we did before, and so that just feels like things are getting worse. But I think it's just we've been allowed to see ourselves more clearly, and there's a lot of grieving that comes along with that.
Mm-hmm. Now, your superhero metaphor, which is what the book is all about. The powers of superheroes. That comes from deep in your personal history, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. I mean, I grew up, as many kids do, with those mythologies there, wanting to be Peter Parker, wanting to be Spider-Man. I think thinking that I had sort of latent, abilities that I hadn't discovered, some sort of secret identity. And I just love that idea, because I think we're all kind of hungering for transformation. And I think those superhero stories, they help us kind of experience that.
Mm-hmm. And you write in your book, the desire for significance is buried deep within all of us, and you're trying to call that forth in this book, right?
Yeah, I think, you could. I had a friend who, early on in the process of writing this book, and she said, doesn't anyone remember how to be a decent human being? And, I told her, lots of people do, but I think we need daily reminders, because I think in the middle of our, activity and our mundane, we can easily forget that there's something significant happening with the story that we're living. And we kind of need to need to remember that, and we need to realize that our voices do have resonance, and our individual stories, there's a lot happening there.
And what was your purpose of writing this book? What effect are you hoping it has on readers?
I think just to leave them feeling a little bit lighter than when they started, and maybe having a little bit of clarity about what their, you know, the particular space that they can fill in the world. You know, that's kind of the heart of the book. The question is, what kind of person does the world need? And you ask that question, and then you begin to figure out how you're wired and equipped and, you know, capable of doing that. So there's a lot of stories in the book about ordinary people who saw a gap in the world of compassion or generosity and said, I need to show up there.
You know, as a social activist, and particularly as a Christian pastor, you are kind of a rare breed in the sense that you're calling out a lot of the bigotry, etc., that we see exemplified in certain sectors by evangelists who don't really have a problem with the immorality of Donald Trump. Or, you know, do you see yourself as a provocateur?
Well, I think any time that you're pushing back against something that's established, especially, you know, from inside, being a Christian, being a pastor, and saying those things, speaking out on, you know, matters of sexuality or equality, I think you're always going to get pushback, and you're always going to be, you know, viewed that way. So, and but that's kind of the, for me, the fact that I would, that, you know, for example, that advocating for refugees would be something that would be confrontational to the church is sort of, that is the problem in itself.
You know, this is a book about the intersection of spirituality and civic engagement, transforming outrage into activism. What would be a couple or three points that help people make the first steps towards doing that? I mean, there's a lot of outrage on both sides of the aisle, but it's really kind of self-defeating, isn't it?
Yeah, I think part of it, you know, there are just some simple sort of checklists that I have people, you know, run through, just even saying, you know, how am I wired? What do I have at my disposal? What are my talents? What are my gifts? Where am I positioned? You know, what's my circle of influence? Because I think we need to remember that all this work really happens in the small and in the close, in the people we know, in the communities we're a part of. So it's not about this sort of large scale activism. It's really about this lifestyle of personal activism. And so I think when we do that, it becomes a little bit more attainable. It becomes a little bit more tangible. And then we don't feel as overwhelmed as we might by just watching the news.
And what do you say to people who feel helpless that they could make much of a difference?
You know, I just remind them that anyone who's really helped them in their lives, anyone who's inspired them, largely it's been people who've done really simple acts of kindness, spoken words into their lives. You know, all the people that we find inspirational, there's just, they're people who are completely ordinary and flawed. They're just people who are out there doing those things that need to be done. And so in my story, you know, I'll remind people that, you know, for example, I was fired from my mega church for, you know, talking explicitly into matters of faith and sexuality and diversity and all those things. And then I wrote a blog post that went viral called If I Have Gay Children. And it really, at the time I wrote it, I had no financial capital. I had no job. I had no social media platform. It was just those simple words. And those words did a work. So I just remind people of the resonance of their voices.
And what were those words again?
You know, for me, the blog post that I had written at the time was trying to personalize or humanize something I think a lot of Christians dehumanize. And so I wrote a blog post to my children, you know, if they were LGBTQ, here is what I would promise to them.
I see.
And they were really simple, you know, expressions of love, and but yet somehow those reached people and traveled around the world and millions of people read them. And that really reminded me, and I always tell people, you know, that is exactly where you're positioned. You know, you don't have any other responsibility than to really, from the most authentic place, is to speak and to live, and that will cause ripples. It always does.
And so what happened from there? That blog went viral, and then tell us how did that unfold to create the platform that you have now?
Yeah, I mean, really, literally within a couple of hours, it had reached a few million people. And the next day I'm on CNN, and I always tell people underneath my name, it said John Pavlovitz, pastor, and it could have easily said unemployed and currently despondent. And I just, you know, I kept going and got offered to write a book and then just began traveling the country. And it's been really 3 or 4 years now of just, you know, a few hundred words redirecting my life. And so that for me has just been a complete surprise.
You didn't have any idea that it could go viral or even what that meant?
Yeah, I mean, you can't conceive of that at the time. You just know, hey, here's something. And, you know, for me, in my case, being fired from the evangelical church had freed me to speak more clearly. And once I spoke in that authentic voice, that's when the audience came. So it was, you know, that's a lesson over and over. I try to tell people, when you speak and you live from that truest place, that's the only option. I mean, that's really the only way to live.
And that's one of the superpowers that you call out in your book, courage. We have an inner Hulk. I love that.
Yeah, that's right. We've got stuff that we're really, we spend all of our time in our own shoes and our own skin, and we know our frailties and our faults and all the inner voices. So I think we forget, you know, just how significant an impact we're having on the world, or can.
Now, you talk in the book about pivot points, and I'm going to quote you here. For each of us, there are precise pivot points in this life. Turbulent times when we're called upon to face something that feels bigger than we can handle, or to carry more than we believe we can bear. And you also write that 2016 was a pivot point for you. Explain what you mean.
Well, you know, the waking up, or the really staying up all night of the eve of the election and into the morning, I think it began for me what was really, and for many people, just a time of profound grieving, you know, grieving a lot of things. And people were saying, oh, you know, could you say something? Could you speak into this time? And I wrote another piece that happened to travel around the world, and I got fortunate enough to, you know, have that go viral as well. But that really showed me that, you know, there were millions of people who didn't have to agree with my theology, but they were all feeling the same prompts, asking the same questions, frustrated by the same things. And that gave me encouragement to kind of keep going and to do this work even, you know, more passionately than before.
And what is your vocation now? How do you are you working in a church now, or how do you make a living?
Yeah, well, I still have my home church that I'm a part of, but really, practically speaking, I'm on the road probably 80% of the weekends. And so right now, my sort of job, my ministry, is just to go around and to talk to people and to encourage them. So I get to sort of still be a minister, but I just have a really different sort of ministry model now. And it's a lot freer than it had been before. So I still have a church I'm a part of, but most of my life is traveling and speaking and writing.
And do you find that you're welcome in the Christian community? I mean, considering that Christians are the most solid voting bloc for Trump, I ask the question.
Yeah, I mean, definitely a lot of those churches, the more conservative churches, are going to be leery of me. But I'm, you know, progressive Christianity and sort of moderate mainline Christianity, that's the bulk of where I travel. I mean, those are the people who invite me. And so a lot of times their churches filled with some people who are totally on board with what I'm saying, and some people who are still reluctant Trump supporters, maybe. And so that's what I love, to get into a community like that and really sort of work out all the messiness of this. But there's a huge component of Christians, and then a lot of my readers are, you know, agnostic, atheist, and other faith traditions. And I think that, so that's really, there's a freeness there.
And can you explain, this just confuses me no end. How is it that evangelicals can support Trump? I mean, he's obviously not religious. He lacks morality.
Right.
You know, he's hypocritical as all get out. How can they support him?
Well, I mean, it's a pretty complex, you know, idea, but really it comes down to first fear. I think, you know, conservative religion and politics both leverage fear of the outsider, fear of immigrants, and all those things. And I think a lot of people have been raised with that voice of God in their heads, that sort of white, you know, male American, you know, nationalistic Christianity. And I think that's really, when that's the voice in your head of who God is, it's really hard to get rid of that. And then you put someone in place like Trump, who completely leverages that. I think there are a lot of people who have just been, you know, brainwashing is a difficult term to throw around, but that's really where they are. Because this really isn't even conservative evangelicalism anymore. It's really Trumpism. It's really a cult of personality that has some sort of religiosity sprinkled throughout it.
Right. So to what would you attribute the epidemic of disconnection in America that you write about?
I think probably the worst thing, and people, you know, in my place, people who are progressive are as guilty of it. I think we settle for caricatures of people. We, you know, we sort of make people into cartoons, and we kind of think we know them. And really, my journey to becoming sort of a more progressive Christian, the whole thing that started my deconstruction was getting better stories about people. You know, I was kind of raised with false stories about gay people or people of color. And the more I began to, you know, hear truer stories, those stories changed me. But I think right now we're all sort of seeing a group of people from a distance and trying to think we know them.
Right. Now, you write about four core values: radical hospitality, total authenticity, true diversity, and agenda-free community. How do we put those into practice, and how do you guide people to put them into practice?
Well, those are really sort of, they started with how to build a faith community that was more welcoming. And so in the context of faith community or not, I think part of it is being a story learner. You know, part of, you know, I talk about being in art school and having a professor who was saying, hey, you're drawing this ordinary still life. And as an artist, your job is to show people the beauty in the ordinary that they no longer see. And the way you do that is you become a student of what you draw. And I think we have to become students of other people. We have to learn their stories and linger with them long enough to see the similarities between their lives and our lives.
Now, the ideals of progressive Christians, as you delineate them in your book, are tolerance, inclusion, and radical compassion. But throughout its history, Christianity has been rather exclusive. It just says, if you don't believe the right things, you're out. You can't go to you can't go to heaven unless you have faith in what we tell you to believe, which includes the fact that Jesus is the only way, and the other ways are false, including Buddhism and Taoism and Judaism. Does your inclusiveness include these other faith traditions? I wouldn't even call them faith traditions. You know, Buddhism doesn't really require beliefs as much as practice. But right. But does your inclusiveness take them in?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, and for me, that was the, you know, I felt the tensions in, you know, working as a megachurch pastor. This is would be my 23rd year in ministry. And I, you know, you felt all those tensions. You felt that you wanted to be more open. But in the place where I was standing, it was very difficult to say that sort of clearly. And then getting outside of that, you just see how wide and expansive spirituality is. And so for me, I every day get up and just look for the beauty in all kind of worldviews and traditions. I think they can all be sifted for just really wonderful things. And so for me, that's what I love. And that's probably the thing that threatens conservative Christians most about the work that I do, because as you said, you know, it's all about who's in and who's out. And when you begin to realize that we're probably all in, whatever in is, then you lose that desire to damage people or exclude them.
It's amazing how much we have historically made out of black and white distinctions. Like, for instance, there were wars fought in the Middle Ages about which way to make the sign of the cross, touch the left shoulder first or the right shoulder first. This kind of thing is amazing. It seems to me that when you boil it down, you think about God and how do you define this word God? And a lot of times God is defined as everything, that God is in everything. And it's not like this separate personality that created everything. And that's kind of very similar to like Hinduism. You know, they've got all these gods, but they're all basically different faces of the same creative power. When you boil it down, these distinctions aren't really worth fighting wars over.
Yeah, and I think, you know, what you see in what I've seen in my tradition is people want to assign some sort of personality to God, so to make God very human. And once we do that, we end up trying to make God in, you know, God hates what we hate, and God has the same prejudices we have. And when you stop trying to do that, when you realize that whatever God is, it's really probably beyond anything I'm going to actually capture with words, then it just becomes about, you know, there's something about the mystery of that that's beautiful.
Right, right. Now, you were a comic book aficionado, like so many of us as a kid. You were a real superhero fan. I think it's a very funny story about how you came to realize that you weren't actually a superhero. Can you share that with us?
Oh, sure. You know, I'm 6 years old and I'm running through the woods behind our house and, you know, come across this section of barbed wire and thinking, okay, well, this is where my origin story is going to begin. I'm going to run toward this fence and just leap over it and take to the sky, you know, and then, you know, doing that and you know, just, you know, tearing my leg and having this scar now that's 40, you know, 3 years old that remind, you know, but that day was the day I learned that I can't fly. I'm not super. And I think we all have sort of those moments where we face our limitations and we're reminded of those things.
That was a rude awakening. But, you know, I'm glad that you didn't forsake the whole idea about superpowers, because part two of your book is called Ordinary Superpowers. And we're not going to have time to go into all of them, but I'll just want to list off a bunch of them and see if you want to call out any of them. One of them is a chapter on compassion, sacrifice, humor, humility, honesty, kindness, creativity, courage, persistence, wonder, and gratitude. Such a list of beautiful qualities. How is humor a superpower?
Well, I think humor is medicinal. You know, I think we realize that when we are laughing, when we can actually laugh in the face of what we're doing, we realize we sort of right size the things that we fear. And we, you know, we all understand those moments where we are feeling one way and then we experience something that's of humor and we laugh and it sort of disarms all the things that we had tension about. So I think that people, you know, throughout history, the people, the comedians, they sort of do an amazing service to it for us. And I think so that's, and it's realizing that in the face of grief and in the face of tragedy, how quickly we can use humor, not to just escape the thing, but to really say, I'm going to take power over this thing that I'm laughing at.
I think it's ironic that one of the sub-themes of your book is that we are the heroes we've been waiting for. And I say that because it's in contradistinction to the typical attitude of Christians and other religious folks, is that we look outside ourselves for hopeful saviors when actually we are the heroes we've been waiting for.
Well, I think what we tend to do is a lot of people over spiritualize the world when bad things happen, and they say, oh, I'm going to pray that God does this and God does that, when you're sitting there and you have a life and you have a circle of influence and you have financial resources, and there are a lot of prayers that you can actually begin to answer. You can do this work in the world. And so it's really reminding people that yes, you can have a faith that aspires to something larger than what you can see, but there's a lot that you can do and you can see and you can control, and it's your responsibility to speak into those things.
I love the way your book points to what you call everyday activism. You write, quote, every single movement of justice, every transformative organization, every nurturing community began with two or three people who believed that was enough to start. Any comments on that?
I mean, that's the story. I mean, you look at any beautiful thing in the world, any you know, thing that you admire, any organization, it always started with that sort of burden that one or two people had. And I, you know, I tell some of those stories. I talk about a woman named Natalie Weaver from North Carolina, and whose daughter was born with all sorts of physical challenge and physical deformities. And what she started to live as an advocate for her daughter, but she soon realized that she had an opportunity and a responsibility to advocate for other children. And she and a couple other moms, you know, started taking on the health insurance industry here in North Carolina, started a nonprofit. And, you know, Natalie said, the one thing I didn't want to do was be out front and be a public persona. But yet that's what they asked her to do. And so she said, well, if no one else will do it, I will. And then she's found this gift to do that very thing. So I think that's a huge part of this. These internal burdens, they're prompts to move.
Yeah, just a single movement like that. It's just like you writing that blog that went viral.
That's right. And there would have been, again, been no way to forecast that and say, oh, I'm going to write this and I'm going to do all these things. And, you know, part of the message of the book is you don't even have to quite know what you're doing. You just begin. And because that first step or two will lead you to cross paths with people that you wouldn't otherwise have crossed with. And you meet people and that begins to inform you. And then your activism changes. Right. And so you would have never been able to figure that out until that actually your process of movement begins.
Well, thank you, John. There's so much more we could explore on the subject of everyday activism, on the subject of being the hero you've been waiting for. Beautiful stuff, but we have run out of time. And I want to be sure to tell our listeners about your website before we go, which is www.johnpavlovitz.com. That's John, PAVLOVITZ.com. And for those who tuned in to the Pathways show late, this is your host, Paul O'Brien, author of Great Decisions, Perfect Timing, a book that shares the theme of Pathways, which is personal and cultural evolution. In a second, I'll tell you how you can rewind and replay this interview whenever you like via the internet or as a free podcast. Today we have been visiting with John Pavlovitz, author of Hope and Other Superpowers, a life-affirming, love-defending, butt-kicking, world-saving manifesto. I want to say thank you to all of our listeners for tuning in to Pathways, which is broadcast and streamed via KBOO.fm Sunday mornings at 8:30 USA Pacific Time. Podcasts of this show, which you can listen to and forward to others, are available for free at divination.com. That's spelled divination.com, as well as via iTunes and other free podcast servers. This is Paul O'Brien reminding you to tell your friends about Pathways Radio and Podcast, and thanks again to John Pavlovitz and to all of you listeners for tuning in and being a part of the Pathways podcast.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Here goes nothing.
Tune in to KBOO for Drinking from Puddles, hosted by Brandon, every other Wednesday from 8 to 10 p.m.